Do we have a deal on rail? There's a tentative deal in the works for Honolulu's troubled project. It's already has already come under fire. Will it hold? That's the question that hangs in the air for this year's special legislative session, which begins Monday. Wayne Yoshioka is HPR's political reporter, and he's been watching this for what seems like an eternity. And I don't know, are we approaching some kind of resolution here? It doesn't seem as if this deal necessarily is going to hold, Wayne.
Well, it's a tentative deal, but I think all of the players had to give up something.
Right.
The tourism industry had to give up something. The state has to give up the GET for another 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the big takeaway from all this is that the Honolulu city and county has to also give things up too. Like in 2015, when they went in for the GET surcharge extension for 5 years from 2022 to 2027,
mm-hmm.
they walked away free with $1.2 billion in almost guaranteed revenue. But this time, it's different.
They walked away without any givebacks?
That's right. They didn't have any skin in the game. And throughout the last session, we heard all the finance chairs saying, Honolulu City and County, you've got to put in something. Give us your share. Share these increasing costs with us. And don't just say, put a gun to our head and say, it's up to you now to fund this rail.
Well, that whole perception of a gun being put to the head, now the gun seems to be pointed from the state to the city. I mean, and then there are reports of a great deal of tension behind the scenes, yeah?
And a lot of pushback from Mayor Kirk Caldwell. We don't know if those are true stories or not, but he says that we are about $600 million short of the $3 billion that they need to fund the last 4.2 miles from Middle Street to Ala Moana Center.
And that's even with the deal being proposed, a hike of the GET hotel room tax, et cetera.
Correct. And the point of the legislature is we're going to save on finance charges by giving you cash from the transient accommodations tax
mm-hmm.
up front. And so that will give you at least $208 million. And we're going to have no funding for HART. No funding for HART. And I have a clip here from Senator Donovan de la Cruz, who's the chair of the Senate Ways and Means Committee.
HART originally came in at $1.4 billion for finance costs, and we'll be able to reduce that amount by $208 million. We're also not going to be paying for operations of HART, so that's going to include a total of $281 million. We're not going to be paying for marketing. That's $151 million. So we can reduce the $281, the $151, and the $208 million for financing. Because of the way we're using the TAT, that's going to help save the taxpayers quite a bit of money.
So what that translates to is basically $430 million that the city has to come up with to fund HART and a $151 million marketing plan.
You have to wonder how that money was spent earlier, because that is a lot of money to spend on marketing for something that, if it's as beneficial as it's been touted, should market itself. What's to market?
That's true, too. And this bill, this draft bill, also calls for a state auditor to audit the spending plan for the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation.
Which has not, to this date, been audited by anyone?
No, they've been audited by the FTA. They've been audited by an independent contractor. But there's nothing that has been made publicly known as far as where did all this money go. Was it because it was contracted right? Were the bids too high? All of those things remain unanswered as of this date.
It seems unusual to get this far along in a project without that kind of rigorous scrutiny and without that the results of that scrutiny being made public, yeah?
Yeah, I would think so. I think the best way to encapsulate all this is to go back to Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa, who was the chair of HART from mm-hmm. 2015 to 2016, and she really explains where we are.
Remember, this project started off at 3.9 under Mayor Hanneman, the estimates, and then under the FFGA, which was in 2012, December, it was supposed to be 4.9, but the 5.1 is the contingency. And then we went to 6.8 at the end of June of last year, and now construction alone is almost $8.2 billion. So when you look at the growth in terms of the cost, even from 6.8 to 8.2, it's a huge amount of money that we're talking about. The problem I've always seen is the fact that when I was on the HART board, you know, the engineers told me that there wasn't a problem with the Dillingham Boulevard segment, and I always thought that was going to be the killer for the city center project. I am hoping that in this last assessment, they keep telling me, yes, we've got it down, it's all included, we know what we need to do. So if that's the case, then the so-called extra money that the city is asking for is really the financing costs of the project. So the way the state legislature has addressed it is they have assumed the construction costs as set forth by HART. And what they're looking at is how to pay for it as they incur the costs to minimize the amounts going out. So that if we're able to pay for it as it's being built, then the amount of money needed from the people is going to be reduced because you're not paying a long-term mortgage.
And so we'll see how that draft bill does. The special session begins Monday, so we'll see how it goes, Chris.
That we will, Wayne. Thanks very much for checking in with us. Wayne Yoshioka is H. Paris political reporter, and you can find his stories covering rail financing and the legislature on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a look at the current political landscape from former Governor Neil Abercrombie. But first, your quiz. In the backyard today, we're searching for a local girl who made good. If good is a measure of having won 2 Tony, 3 Emmy, 3 Grammy, and 4 Golden Globe Awards. She's a Radford High School grad whose first taste of show business came with a bit part in the film Hawaii. That was the 1966 epic that starred Julie Andrews. Our mystery woman followed the path of the stage struck and moved to New York. Between working as a go-go dancer and studying acting, singing, and dance, she got the chance to use all of those skills when she learned that the owner of a popular bathhouse was looking for weekend entertainment. With her combination of sass and showbiz savvy, what followed in that unlikely venue became a springboard for international success. For today's backyard quiz, who is this triple threat star? And for extra points, who's the movie star she's named after? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And, of course, the first one to get it right gets the Backyard Quiz reusable tote to tell everybody you did.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Douglas Trade Shows, serving Hawaii since 1983, producing annual trade shows and expositions, and providing management services for trade events. DouglasTradeShows.com.
By this point in his career, Neil Abercrombie has held most of the political positions of power. He was a Honolulu City Council member. He held seats in both houses of the Hawaii Legislature and then became Hawaii's congressman in the U.S. House of Representatives. In 2010, he became the 7th governor of the state until 2014. In the very changed and ever-evolving political landscape, we asked former Governor Abercrombie for his take on Hawaii and its congressional delegation. Governor Abercrombie, good to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so very much for having me. I was hoping I could participate in the quiz.
That's because you know the answer.
Yes, if somebody hasn't gotten that already, shame on them.
So as you look at, first of all, what we heard from yesterday's press conference about the rail deal, what's your assessment of it?
Well, it's interesting that we talk about the rail deal. When did mass transit become rail? That's really probably the key to trying to figure out everything that's happened since then. It was never rail. It was always mass transit. I guess I'm the last person alive, literally, that has actually seen or been involved in the mass transit aspect of transportation on Oahu, on the leeward side of Oahu, right from the very beginning. The old 3M Council, before there was an H1, Mo'ili'ili, Makiki, and Manoa, Frank Fossey came to explain how he thought that it would have to be an alternative transportation system, mass transit system, in addition to the bus system. So it's been going on all those years. It was always mass transit. The second it became rail, it literally changed dimensions, and that's why we're in the dilemma we're in today.
So what do you make of the deal as it's being talked about now, the deal that seemingly not a lot of people are happy with?
Well, why would they be? Everyone who has been a part of trying to find a solution, which is now being called a deal, which in and of itself tells you why there's a difficulty here. Why would you be making a deal on something as opposed to merely fulfilling a contract?
So what would you think has to happen if it's not this deal?
Well, it's not so much a matter of whether it's this deal or not. The question is everybody keeps avoiding the question, which is, what is the bottom line? It's all being put off. And the General Treasury is being raided in order to do this. And the implications from this are extraordinarily profound. The only thing that I can see to do at this stage that makes any sense, if the particulars of this deal are as has been reported, is to stop.
In the interest of time, I want to ask you about some other things,
sure,
too. As you look at the state now, and you've been out of office for a little while, which gives you an interesting perspective to
yes.
be able to watch and see.
Yeah.
How are you assessing some of those issues that you felt were most important when you were in office?
Well, they're not being directly dealt with other than by indirection. The most important thing from my point of view was the young people, the future. That involved preschool, universal preschool, and universal digital education. All of that's being ignored, set aside. Our children are being prevented from being truly able to enter the 21st century. And at the same time, then, we continue to find money for projects like this rail, including taking money away from the state. The state retained. Let me give you a quick example. There is a phrase, say, the so-called skim, 10% that the state charges the city for the excise tax. That's not a skim. That's general fund money. That was the price of loan of giving the money to the city. And now, if this deal is correct, that's being taken away, or 3%, $27 million a year. And this goes to like 2030 now. That means hundreds of millions of dollars that could go for senior services, for fixing the roads that almost kept me from getting here today, for preschool, for digital education of our kids. All of that disappears. I just think it's utterly irresponsible.
Talk to me about homelessness.
Well, there's another example. We came up. We had the idea of the housing first. You have to put people in housing, not just shelter, but into housing with requisite programs. Take Chinatown, where I am right now. My office is in Chinatown. I'm there all the time. What's needed there in Chinatown, and exists especially through the IHS, are programs for the mentally disabled, for addicts, for the derelicts on the street. But we don't put them into the programs. We're not putting that kind of money. And we spend $4 million to move people from one place to another. I work out at the New Guana Y, right behind the Y. There was an encampment there. It was routed out for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that was replicated all over. People are coming back. They're right there. You have to have a complete program. You should have a mobile court that decides whether someone is mentally disabled, whether they're addicted. You put them into programs. You send them there. You have flying squads of the sheriffs or the HPD or a combination that move people off the street into a competent court setting, into medical and or other service programs. You have to do it comprehensively. It's not being done.
So what do you make of the goals for Hawaii shelters that we're going to talk about later in the program that tie funding to how well those goals are met as HUD outlines them?
Well,
which is largely housing first.
Yeah, but you have to go ahead and do it. You can't use a punishment a kind of approach. It has to be comprehensive to begin with. Chinatown's a good example. The Chinatown, you should be doing it. The young entrepreneurs I see in Chinatown every day are being hurt because of three things. Not these bulb outs about pedestrian safety. Pedestrian safety is hit because there's not enough police on the street. We don't have neighborhood police watch sufficient numbers at the Mauna Kea station. You don't remove people from the street who frighten people and who scare people and who are in desperate need of help. And you don't have the necessary parking that could be there and the housing that needs to be done.
While we're talking about things that aren't there but that are necessary.
It has to be comprehensive. That's my point.
What would you say about the progress that's been made on unfunded liabilities?
It isn't being made. That's the reason we pay now in unfunded liabilities, because I forced that issue. It's one of the reasons I'm sitting here rather than down and at the Capitol at the moment. But I forced the issue because it has to be addressed. And we had a game plan for that. Now, the unfunded liabilities for the pensions and the health care fund, which has no money in it and is pay-as-you-go, does not have sufficient funds. And when you give money to rail, for example, you're taking money out of the general revenues to meet those obligations. I don't see how you can keep on doing that.
This is a very changed political climate than was when you were either in Washington or
yes,
certainly here down at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. How do you view the position of Hawaii, its strength or its ability to get things done in the best interest of the state, given what you're seeing in Washington?
Well, that takes me back to, again, one of the reasons I'm sitting here rather than down in the Capitol. That was the appointment of Brian Schatz to the U.S. Senate. I, to my dying day, as I take my last breath, I will have a smile on my face because I appointed Brian Schatz to the United States Senate. No matter what happens with the present executive incumbent, no matter what takes place in terms of the trauma and political difficulties, the United States Senate is going to depend on seniority. And Brian Schatz is going to be a leader in the United States Senate. He's a leader now. He's very well liked. He has a bipartisan capacity to engender support for himself and for Hawaii. We could not be better placed in the Congress of the United States and in the Senate in particular than to have Brian on the Appropriations Committee.
And what about in Congress?
And in Congress itself, we have our representatives on the Armed Services Committee, which I think is very, very important, and on the Resources Committee. Again, Brian is in that position. Mazie Hirono sits on the Armed Services Committee. So in terms of institutional authority and capacity for Hawaii to have an impact, and in terms of subject matter that affects Hawaii most directly, Hawaii is very well placed in a congressional situation.
What about their ability to make impacts for health care? I mean, that's been the political football.
Well, of course, that transcends Hawaii. And but they can have an impact. One of the things I have tried to put forward over the years is the prepaid health care plan that Hawaii put into effect in 1975, passed in 74, came in 1975 when I entered the legislature. So we have more experience with pre-existing conditions, community-based rating. The entire bill, you know, is only about 8 or 9 pages long. The whole thing is about 12 pages, which includes the mission statement and how it works. The whole thing is run out of the Department of Industrial Relations, by the way, you know, out of the Labor Department with a few computers and a couple of professionals running it. The expenses, in other words, are virtually nil. What we need to have is what Brian and the congressional delegation support, which is, in effect, Medicare for All. Which would combine the state contributions through Medicaid, and you have your Medicare card becomes your national health card. I've been fortunate all these years, and I always told everybody I have national health care. I'm a Kaiser member. I joined Kaiser when Henry Kaiser was still with us, and where the Prince Hotel is, that was the Kaiser Hospital. So I had it in Washington. I had it in California, which is where I landed a lot on an airplane, and in Hawaii. So all you have to – if you want to still have a private sector at all, you have to have a health maintenance operation like Kaiser. And you either contract for it or just go to Medicare for All. That's what the Hawaii delegation supports. And I think we have credibility because we have the best operating medical care system of any state in the union.
Well, I hope your health continues to be well and that all things go well. Thank you so much for the visit.
Is that a frightening prospect for people?
I guess that depends on how they feel about it, but I'm very happy that at least you're here and well, and thank you so much for coming in for the visit.
Great pleasure for me. Thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you. Neil Abercrombie served as the 7th governor of the state of Hawaii from 2010 to 2014. He's also held seats in both houses of the Hawaii legislature, the U.S. House of Representatives, and the city and the Honolulu City Council.
Did you have a winner yet?
As we alluded to in the conversation a moment ago with Governor Abercrombie, there are new goals for Hawaii's shelters for homeless people. Some worry that could mean the loss of funds if the shelters can't meet those goals. Civil Beat reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim has the reality check. Hi, Natanya.
Hi, Bethann. Thanks for having me on.
Good to talk to you. So what is the big impetus now that wasn't there before? I thought the whole thing was moving toward HUD's dictum that we should be in a housing first model.
Certainly. So the states had contracts with Hawaii homeless shelters for a long time, but for the first time, the state is tying the funding that it gives to shelters with the shelter's performance. So depending on how the shelter performs on 7 different performance measures, the state will look at the success of the shelter's ability to meet these measures and tie the funding to that.
Can you quickly go through what those measures are, just so people have an idea of now what's being asked of the shelters?
Sure. I'll give a few examples. Both emergency and transitional shelters are expected to have beds 85% full on average. And this arises from an issue that shelters were having a year ago where many beds were going unfilled. Another example would be shelters are expected to move people out within a certain number of days. Emergency shelters are expected to have 50% of people moved out in 60 days or less. Transitional shelters, it's 50% of people moved out in 90 days or less.
How long do the shelters have to be able to demonstrate that they are meeting these goals? By what date do they have to give this kind of data and information?
Mm-hmm. The state is phasing in these expectations. There were 2 quarters, so 3-month periods of, the shelter was granted the contracts in February and not expected to meet the goals. Funding was not tied to the goals. But starting in August, the shelters are expected to meet one of the goals. They get to choose the goal, and up to 1% of funding is tied to that goal.
So what are the shelters, or how are they responding to this? For some of them, it seems like this might be real impetus to get them to do what some have wanted to do for a while. For others, it might be something that might, suck the air out of their funding.
Some shelters are definitely concerned. The state is giving them leeway by allowing them to choose which measures are applicable, in these early quarters. And many are worried specifically about the requirement to move a certain percent of people into permanent housing. Larger shelters often have networks with landowners folks who...
Right, but finding those affordable rentals is where I hear you going with this. And if there isn't the inventory,
right,
then what happens? All right. Thanks so much for giving us a beat on it at the moment. And good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today, featuring reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim. Here we are on an Aloha Friday, and as is our custom, we're taking a look at what our news department is working on for the coming week. And to help us with that, news director Bill Dorman joins us now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Happy Aloha Friday, Beth Ann.
You too.
Kicking off, starting with an internal story here at Hawaii Public Radio, we'll be forging ahead next week without you, Beth Ann. And as you head to your next adventure at Kahimohala Behavioral Health, I know we'll be hearing more about that, but on behalf of all of us here at HPR, mahalo for all your work over the years. All the best as you continue with your talents. We'll be watching and cheering for your continued success.
Thank you, Bill. I deeply appreciate that. Thank you so much. There's a lot of good work to be done. But speaking of work to be done, as we're looking into next week, what we've been talking about all morning, looking at that special session.
All eyes on rail. Wayne was on a bit earlier with a bit of a preview, and of course he's going to be covering that all week. Up for some testimony that's going to be familiar to many. Seeing how the civility levels go on this is something that's going to be really interesting.
That defines us in many ways.
It really does. And sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle of numbers and, this many years for this extension and this percentage. But that that degree of civility and the spirit of aloha that does or does not come through with this is a subtext to this entire debate and discussion this coming week. So we're certainly going to be hearing a lot about that. We'll see which directions it goes.
As we look forward to what may be coming out of next week, we also have to look back a little bit to be able to understand how we got here.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So Noe Tanigawa has done a lot of work in terms of talking with people who have been involved with rail back to the Harris administration through UV Hanneman, through planning and shifting and developing. And she's going to be able to bring some insights and some pieces from her discussions over time that, passed as prologue.
And speaking of that, we've had a little bit of past talking about the transit accommodation tax, but there's a whole story just in that part of this so-called deal.
That really is true as well. Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to be looking at how the TAT's evolved over time. Not really beloved by the tourism industry, as you know, but it's changed and developed over the years, and that's definitely part of the story going forward.
All right, well, I'll be listening. Thanks, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
And it's Friday, which means that we're airing some of the feedback you've sent us this week. Justin Hahn called into Town Square yesterday to express his displeasure with the use of the word howly on the air. He wrote this on our Facebook page yesterday. I called to make a point that people are ignoring each other's opinions and refusing to have an honest conversation, and also that I didn't like someone on public radio using a racial epithet. Then the privileged hosts of the show ignored my manao and proceeded to tell me why my beliefs were wrong and refused to enter into a conversation with me. It's 1984 all over again. By the way, I was born and raised in Hawaii.
Wayne Reese listened back to one of our old interviews with musician Harry Sawyer Jr. and wrote in, "Throughout the years, Harry Sawyer Jr. has become a priceless resource of Hawaiian music history, which we're all grateful for, and I surely am, too. I am still living in Utah for over 23 years now, and I come home as often as I can. Mahalo for all you do to keep Hawaiian music alive."
Following yesterday's discussion on Town Square, Rose Darling wrote in from Maui to say, "Mahalo, Bethann Kozlovich, for illuminating this issue on Hawaii Public Radio's Town Square. We'll miss hearing your voice when you step down. For now, continue your wonderful work."
Thank you all so, so very much. Now, if you've got something to say, you can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or reach out to us, as some of you have done, on Facebook and Twitter. As you know, food security is a huge concern for Hawaii. We're continually told we import 80 to 90% of what we need to feed ourselves. In a small and finite space, farming smarter could get a boost from a relatively new agricultural technology platform. According to the startup Smart Yields, its intuitive and customizable mobile app will give farmers, indoor growers, and gardeners real-time information, trends and forecasts, and recommendations. And something else comes along with this app, the blessing of the Pope. Lead founder and CEO Vincent Kimura dropped by our studio earlier, and we talked about what he says is what we all need to do to increase our own food security.
First and foremost, we all need to grow. We all need to have green thumbs, everyone, be it from our children, obviously our future children and whatnot. And part of the challenge that we wanted to face and solve is how can we get non-traditional farmers to get interested in agriculture or interested in growing, be it, you know, someone at home with a small little home garden, someone at school learning about biology and plants and whatnot, but obviously to our farming community. So the majority of the world's farmers are small to medium size. It's actually 99% of them. And yet 99% of them have had, you know, lack of data and lack of technology adoption. So fortunately, the corn, wheat, soy, and a lot of the bigger farms have a lot of technology adoption. But when you look at the barriers to entry, which are mostly hardware-driven and also connectivity-driven, it's a big challenge.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because for a farmer that may be far away from any sort of internet connection, what do you do to be able to have that data continually growing and updating and available in real time to someone if they're, you know, out in the hinterland?
Yeah. Well, broadband access is a big issue for the government, and so they've appropriated quite a bit of money to broadband in rural areas. You know, we saw this connectivity issue first and foremost when we started out with some of our early betas on the Big Island. And simply, when you scale from 10 sensors to 100 or 200 sensors, it's just not cost effective. So that feasibility from the financial sense is really the biggest challenge we faced in getting this technology out to the small farmer. So we've been luckily looking outside the box at Hawaii and looked across the pond and even across the world. So we've been adopting different technologies that have been really kind of opening up things in the innovative space for IoT, which is the Internet of Things in smart cities. So I'm a big fan of not reinventing the wheel here. So how can we take great technologies that have worked in one sector and see if it can work in the oldest industry in the world?
So what did you apply from what you'd learned elsewhere that would be specifically applicable to a farmer, and particularly a small farmer?
So first and foremost, it's, as I said, the financial sustainability, feasibility is the biggest issue. So, you know, focusing on what is the end goal? Is it just the data? And that was one of the first things we realized. And you know, I'm a big fan of the design thinking methodology of, you know, failing fast, failing often, failing early. So we realized that, you know, just showing data on a dashboard added zero insights to the farmer, especially a small farmer, because
if you don't understand it, what does
exactly,
it mean?
Exactly, exactly. So they don't have agronomists or plant physiologists on there. Their knowledge base is our agricultural extension agents who, they're, you know, God bless them, they work tirelessly to help these small farmers with providing information and intelligence and just best practices.
What do you have them do to gain some sense of comfort with all of this? Because I can imagine a farmer who says, I know what I'm doing and I know how to do it well, but that might be a little scary.
You know, when we started off, to address your question, is, you know, we kind of talked to them about yields and whatnot. And every farmer I met was like, well, what are you going to tell me about how I do it and, you know, how I do it well? And we learned early on, it's like, we don't really bring that up. So, but we like to talk and learn. So first and foremost, obviously, we come at it from a very educational, a lifelong learner perspective. And, you know, what are your pain points? How do you do things? You know, what? No farmer is the same as another. You know, each one has their own little recipe. And that's really what we focus on. You know, there's different ways of how folks do things and figuring out how you adopt the technology, adapt the technology into their current procedures and infrastructures. And the one thing that they're all looking for is how to maximize, I guess, the effectiveness. Because the biggest thing they're looking for is to reduce, you know, big cost items like labor or water or fertilizers and maybe even chemicals and pesticides.
While they're increasing their yield.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I just got back from Colorado, and one of our early adopters there, who's a big peach and orchard gentleman out there and right near Grand Junction, you know, he adopted our technology, and it was fascinating to learn about what he had done using it. And, you know, back in early, about May, they had this crazy late frost. And as one farmer explained it to us, they had seen June temperatures, but in February. So what happened is the plants thought it was springtime. So they started flowering and fruiting. And then all of a sudden, this major late frost hit the region.
And there went that crop.
Oh, yes. 50 to 90% of their crop. And it was terrible. But I think the interesting thing that we see is climate change is happening. Climate change is changing everything all around the world. And one individual kind of mentioned, it's like, well, you're kind of updating the Farmer's Almanac, aren't you? Because you're kind of throwing that out, and it's no longer relevant today.
It's funny that you bring that up, because for such a long time, there's been that tried and true reliance on something because it has had the longevity and proof of time. But now, because things are changing, how do you hedge your bets if you're a farmer and you may or may not have some of that information? And how does your technology help a farmer who is trying to cope?
You know, I've kind of mentioned this before to folks. It's, you know, all we really do is knowledge share. It's about education, first and foremost. And it's about aligning, you know, the world's leading agricultural institutions together with the most innovative farmers, especially the small farmers together, because, you know, we've got to feed another 3 billion mouths, and it's going to be kind of tough to do it in 30 years, especially since we have a billion people starving. So first and foremost, explaining to them that there's a bigger issue here, that we're all collectively working together, and that trust factor with working with farmers is the most important, you know, gaining their trust, and really allowing them and encouraging them to try something new. You obviously find those early adopters out there who, you know, will always be innovators in this space. But, you know, it's the other thing, too, is how we can build a community. And that's one thing that I've really been talking a lot of folks, especially in the non-agricultural sector. So working with the NGOs of the world, working with, obviously, our governments, local, state, and federal. And I explained to them that, you know, it's about workforce development and it's about community development. Smart Yields is the glue that brings the data together. You know, we created a mobile app, and we just thankfully released our app in the App Store about a month ago. And we've got a pretty amazing team of individuals who are very passionate about solving some of the hardest global challenges out there.
So how do you begin to move through all of that geopolitical sludge where you have so many conflicting interests, and yet we still have the bottom line of having to feed an increasing population?
I think the fascinating thing I realized about 3-4 months ago is that it's definitely a multi-stakeholder approach. We have to get buy-in from the top and from the bottom. Being that it's obviously a complicated problem to solve, you know, that's kind of one of the reasons why we're really excited about being part of the Laudato Si' Challenge. You know, Pope Francis is probably one of the most remarkable individuals who's ever really kind of steered the Catholic Church. And, you know, as one person said, you know, they don't deal in years or decades. They deal in eternity. So being...
Or at least millennia.
Yeah, millennia. So being one of the largest kind of landowners in the world globally, they are all about community development and all about, you know, helping... Really, it's development equals peace, which is what Pope John Francis II said. So I'm not Catholic, but they're very embracing about bringing together all these different individuals. And they challenged the venture capital community as well as the startup community to not just focus on profits, focus on the social impact. So interesting enough, last week they announced they are now an official social impact investor, which is pretty interesting.
We're going to wait and see how all of this plays out, but I wish you all the best with it. A lot of hungry bellies will be depending upon how well we're able to feed ourselves here in Hawaii and around the world.
Thank you so much for that.
Vincent Kimura is the lead founder and CEO of Smart Yields. The Hawaii-based ag tech startup brings smart farming benefits to small and medium-sized farms. He was named Ag Entrepreneur of the Year by the Hawaii Venture Capital Association and last year was among the Pacific Business News 40 Under 40 to Watch.
Aloha, I'm songwriter Tim Rose, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the girl from Radford High who went on to show business fame. Her persona was described by the late local columnist Eddie Sherman as being a wild young Carmen Miranda with a touch of Mae West. Her career took off when her campy performances at New York City's Continental Baths, where she was accompanied on piano by a young Barry Manilow, truly became the talk of the town. She was named after her mother's favorite star, Betty Davis, though she pronounced it a little differently. A former theater student and a struggling young performer, Bette Midler went on to become the divine Miss M. And that's our quiz for today.
And Napua Burke called us from Hilo and knew the answer first, although this was a very, very busy quiz.
Yes.
Lots of people knew the answer, including Governor Abercrombie.
Yes, he would have won it if we let him.
That's right. We had to scratch him from the list because he was in the studio with us. But thanks so much for playing the Backyard Quiz. And if you have a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha mai kākou. This is Ku'uwipo Kumukahi, Manager of Hawaiian Culture and Community Relations at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki. If you want to listen back to a show, visit The Conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Few watch a solar eclipse with the intensity of astronomers. Each new celestial event offers the opportunity to gather new and valuable data. We asked Dr. Shadi Habal, astronomer and faculty chair of the Solar Physics Department at the Institute for Astronomy, why this latest eclipse was so important.
This is the only opportunity to acquire observations of the corona. And at present, there is no other instrument in space or on the ground that provides the observing conditions that a total solar eclipse provides.
What is it that we are looking to learn from the corona itself?
Well, there are lots of things. For example, we need to understand why the corona is so much hotter than the solar surface. The solar surface is at 6,000 degrees and the corona is at several million. So we still don't know exactly what are the processes that cause this sudden rise in temperature. We need to understand the composition, you know, the chemical composition of the corona. And, for example, at these very high temperatures, the elements or the atoms are not in the in a state that you find, you know, on Earth. They're highly ionized, so they have lost lots of their electrons, and they emit light in different parts of the spectrum. And from these emission, we can learn a lot about the composition, and we can learn, we try to infer something about the physical processes that are causing these ions to reach the state they are in.
So you can actually, by looking at the visible spectrum, learn about chemical composition, is that right?
For example, I mean, what I mean by chemical composition is and when you take a spectrum, let's say you, for example, when you see a rainbow, there are different colors in the rainbow,
right,
and that's due to refraction in the atmosphere. But each part of each color it corresponds to a certain element that is emitting at a very precise color or wavelength. And so from the analysis of this color, we can tell whether it's iron or if it's nickel or if it's calcium. And we can also tell how many, you know, what is its state, for example. Has it lost 10 electrons? Has it lost 11 electrons, etc.?
And only while the main body of the sun is obscured can you make
yes.
these determinations?
That's precisely the only time when you can make it, because the corona is very, very faint. So it's always there on every day. You see the sun, but you don't see the corona because the sun is so bright. It's just like the stars are always there in the sky, but you don't see them during the daytime because the sun is too bright.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to totally obscure the disk of the sun to be able to see the corona.
And there's no way to do that by artificial means?
There are ways to do it by artificial means, but the difference is that the moon is a very large blocker, and it just so happens that its size and the relative distance between the Earth and the sun and also the diameter of the sun is such that when you get a perfect alignment, you can totally obscure the sun. If you, with a man-made occulter, which exists both on satellite and also on telescopes on the ground, you can block the disk of the sun, but then you cannot dim the sky to the level that you dim it during a total solar eclipse.
Yeah.
So you can see the corona out to a certain distance, but you're limited in distance. And what's important for us is to be able to follow the evolution of, you know, the structures you see in the corona from the surface all the way to several solar radii. And that you can only do during a total solar eclipse.
Do we learn a little bit more with each succeeding eclipse?
Yes, we do.
And I assume it's a little early to evaluate what we've learned from this latest one, but was this
Yes, from this one, yes, we haven't. It's been only a few days, and we know that we got excellent data, but we need to analyze it in more depth to understand, the impact of what we have achieved.
But the feedback from the community was that you were getting good data all the way along its path.
Yes. So we had five observing sites separated, you know, from west to east by 1,200 miles. So we collected data in some of the sites. We had identical instrumentation. In others, we had something slightly different. So between the five sites, we collected a significant amount of data, and we got, and the quality is very high. Fortunately, before the total solar eclipse, the weather prospects across all the path of totality across the U.S. didn't look very good because of all the wildfires in Canada and in the western Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
But then somehow the skies cleared and we had very excellent observing conditions. It is very intense. I mean, it took us several years to prepare for this, to select the sites, to select the instrumentation that we wanted to use. And so it's a lot of work. And there are fine details that haunt you till the end, and you want to make sure everything's in order just before you start observing.
Dr. Shadi Habal is an astronomer and faculty chair of the Solar Physics Department at the UH Institute for Astronomy. She studies solar winds, eclipses, and solar magnetic fields.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
On the next Applause in a Small Room, we'll share a concert featuring Brazilian virtuoso guitarist Carlos Barbosa Lima. He played the first half of the concert solo, and in the second half, he was joined by classical Hawaiian guitarist Ian O'Sullivan and music educator and composer Byron Yasui. That's Carlos Barbosa Lima with Ian O'Sullivan and Byron Yasui on the next Applause in a Small Room, Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR 1.
And that's it for this week. Coming up next week, a look at the modern political practice of dog whistling with the man who wrote the book on the subject.
Meanwhile, we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'll still be at BKOZ HPR.
And if you missed part of The Conversation or any other show we air, you can find them all on the HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kosovich.
And this is my last day co-hosting this program. My deepest thanks to the very best staff I could ask for, producer Lillian Song and production assistants Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn, and my co-host and friend Chris Vandercook. I will truly miss each of you. I loved creating this program and engaging with all of you whenever you called or wrote. Thanks for listening and for making this show a part of your lives.
I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Kosovich. I'll see you in our community and join Chris on Monday and pick up The Conversation.
Science is big. Think the power of the Big Bang or the distance from here to Pluto. But science can be small, a tiny virus in your bloodstream. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me each week on Science Friday as we sort through the latest news in science and cut science down to size. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday afternoons from 1 to 3. Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.